Blood was on the mirror, the white wash basins, the floor. A man's body was in the corner, his neck twisted against the wall. His white shirt was soaked with blood from just below the chest down. Some blood was on his dark trousers as far down as his knees. His jaw was slack. His eyes, glassy as a stuffed animal's, stared toward the men's room door. On the side of the sink above his head was his bloody, streaked handprint. Water was still running in the basin. A knife had been dropped into it. Water swirling around the knife was still bloody. Fletch's two hands could not stop what was about to happen. He went to a basin nearer the door. He vomited. He rinsed out the basin. He vomited again. After rinsing the sink a second time, he stood against the basin a moment to steady himself. Then he rubbed cold water on his face, the back of his neck. Using the bottom of his shirt around his hand, he opened the men's room door. Eyes stinging, temples throbbing, knees shaking, Fletch tried to walk straight across the airport terminal while he tucked in his shirt. Chapter 9. The sunlight on the sidewalk outside the Nairobi airport was brilliant. Barbara was showing the taxi driver how to weight down one end of the skis with a knapsack so they could stick out of the trunk without falling. Many people stood around very interested in this problem of transporting skis by taxi. Trembling, Fletch crossed the sidewalk directly to the taxi. He sat on the back seat. He rolled down the window. He sucked warm, dry air into his lungs. Bending, Barbara looked through the back door of the taxi at him. Fare to the Norfolk Hotel should be about 170 shillings. I exchanged a $100 bill for local currency inside at the bank window. Adjusting to the light inside the taxi, her eyes narrowed. What's the matter with you? What happened?
Get in, please.
She sat on the back seat. Can't take a little jet lag?
Close the door, please.
Do I look as badly as you do? Fletch, what's the matter?
Speaking softly, he said,
I just saw someone get murdered, stabbed to death. Blood. He tried to rub the brilliant sunlight out of his eyes. Blood everywhere. My God, you're serious.
She sat closer to him on the seat.
Everywhere where?
Men's room.
She too spoke softly. What do you mean, you saw a murder? My God, this is terrible.
At the back of the car, the driver was trying to arrange the trunk lid so it would not fly up and bounce as they went along the road. Eyes closed, face down, Fletch pressed his fingers against his forehead and cheekbones.
When I went into the men's room, a guy was standing at the basin washing his hands. I went into a cabinet. While I was sitting there, another guy came in. They began shouting at each other. Below the cabinet door, I saw their feet get excited, do this crazy dance. There was a loud shout from one of them, agony, distress.
Barbara put her arm over Fletcher's shoulder.
I came out as quickly as I could. The second man, the man I hadn't seen before, was slumped in a corner, dead. There was blood everywhere, coming from just below his ribs. There was a bloody hand streak on the wall. His eyes were open, staring at the door. The water was still running in the basin. In the basin was a knife. The water in the basin was red.
You're sure he was dead?
He wasn't blinking.
My God, Fletch, what are we going to do?
She looked through a closed window to the airport terminal.
I don't know.
What can we do?
What have you done so far?
I've thrown up.
You look it.
Into one of the other basins. I cleaned up after myself.
Nice boy.
She took one of his hands in hers.
Do you think anyone else knows about this yet?
Fletch looked through the window at the people standing on the sidewalk. No one seems very excited.
We must tell someone.
Her hand went for the door handle.
Wait a minute.
He took her hand.
Let's think a minute.
What good is thinking going to do? Something terrible has happened. Somebody got murdered. You saw it. We have to tell someone.
Barbara, just wait a minute.
Can you identify the murderer? The first man in the men's room?
Yes.
What did he look like?
Middle-aged, slim, thinning sandy hair, pencil mustache, khaki clothes, safari jacket.
What were they arguing about?
I couldn't tell. Foreign language, Portuguese, I think.
Fletch, we have to tell someone.
Barbara, you're not thinking.
What's to think about? You saw a murder.
We've just arrived in Kenya. We don't know how things are here. Because of the skis, the ski clothes, we made clowns of ourselves coming through customs. Come on, that was funny. Yeah, and the press will report we were not acting normally going through customs. We seemed confused. I am confused. I know. I've written reports like that. Barbara, we attracted the attention of the two gun-carrying soldiers. True. What are we doing in Kenya? What are we doing in Kenya with skis? We're here to meet my father. Prove it. There's this washed-out letter inviting us. It's illegible. We're not on very solid ground here. You're just reporting a murder. I don't want to have anything to do with a murder. This isn't California. We've just arrived in a foreign country. We don't know what it's like here. I go into a men's room. There's someone in there alive. I come out and report there is someone else in the men's room who is dead. And you expect people to believe I had nothing to do with it? Come on, Barbara, what would you think? I didn't come halfway around the world to be taken off immediately in handcuffs and leg irons to the local police warehouse. Did anyone notice you go into the men's room? How do I know? Or come out? Barbara, you're right. Until a better suspect comes along, you're the best the police would have. Just an airport incident. You have no evidence that there was another guy, a third guy in the men's room? Nothing but my word. And that's the word of a guy who has just arrived on the equator, carrying skis and ski clothes, waving an illegible invitation from a man whom the courts in California declared dead years ago. Shaky ground. Without a leg to stand on. Fletch, we have been moving pretty fast here. Yeah, lots of fun until something goes wrong. Annoyed, Barbara looked through the window at the terminal again. Why didn't your father meet us at the airport? He's a pilot. He has to know where the airport is. Fletch didn't say anything. He exhaled slowly. Your breath smells like an old cat's, Barbara said. Do you still feel sick? Good thing British Air didn't give us much breakfast. The driver passed by Fletch's window. Barbara, don't say anything about this. The driver can hear. Barbara sighed. Your decision. Before starting the engine, the driver turned around in the front seat and looked at Fletch. Jumbo.
Habari,
Fletch breathed. The driver's forehead wrinkled.
Mzuri sana.
My husband's sick, Barbara said. Must be something he ate. For the first time, Fletch heard the two-note song, B-flat, F.
Sorry.
In a land where people, even a broad-shouldered taxi driver, sang so sweetly, so gently their simple courtesies, oh, I see, sorry. How could Fletch possibly have seen what he just saw? A clean public lavatory turned into a blood-spattered, blood-streaked, blood-puddled room of horror in less time than it took for him to relieve himself. Like seeing a snake come out of a hen's egg. Again, Fletch rubbed his eyes with his fists. The man sat in a pool of blood, spraddle-legged on the floor in the corner of the room, his neck twisted, his eyes staring unblinking at the door, blood everywhere below his ribcage. Damn, Barbara expostulated. Your father didn't come to meet us at the airport. Softly, Fletch said, I guess he didn't. As the taxi pulled away from the curb, it passed a group of people packing into a van. From behind the van walked quickly the first man Fletch had seen in the men's room, thinning combed hair, pencil mustache, the murderer. He carried his safari jacket rolled up in his hand. Small sections of his khaki trousers were dark brown, wet. Fletch said, Hey, wait a minute. The taxi slowed. The driver looked at Fletch through the rearview mirror. Barbara asked, Are you going to be sick? The man, the murderer, had his hand on the door handle of a parked car. He was looking around. Fletch did feel sick again. Go ahead, Barbara said to the driver. He'll be all right. The taxi proceeded through the gate. The moment had passed. Barbara took Fletch's hand into her lap. You going to be all right? I'll be all right. Just a shock. The last thing I expected to see. It was the last thing someone did see. She squeezed his hand. Welcome to Africa. What in hell are we doing here? When you arrive at a ski lodge in Colorado, you're handed a cup of hot chocolate. Somehow, Fletch said, I don't think this welcoming was arranged by the Kenyan Tourist Bureau. No, Barbara said, but I would have expected your father to be here. He arranged the tickets. He knew when we were arriving. Altogether, it would have been a help having him here. Again, Fletch exhaled heavily. Slowly, on the drive into Nairobi from the airport, Fletch became more alert to his surroundings. The taxi went at a sedate pace. Worriedly, the driver kept glancing in the rearview mirror. As they went along, the trunk lid bounced higher and higher. The snow skis sticking out of the trunk of a taxi driving into Nairobi, Kenya, attracted a lot of attention. Other drivers smiled at them, blew their horns, waved at what appeared to be a joke or at least something funny. People on the sidewalks pointed. A few people seemed to know or were able to figure out what they were. Others just found two blue fangs sticking out the back of a flapping Mercedes funny enough. As they began to go around a rotary, Fletch saw, on his left, a children's playground. Everywhere in the playground were oversized traffic signs. Stop, railroad crossing, wait, walk, caution. Fletch said, "People here like their kids." Barbara frowned at him. "People everywhere like their kids. I've never seen an urban park dedicated to teaching kids traffic signs before." The car slowed before making a U-turn to pull up at the front door of the Norfolk Hotel. "Oh, no," Barbara said. "Oh, no what? It's beautiful." The hotel looked like a Tudor hunting lodge in tropical sunlight. In front, a deep-covered veranda, a bar-restaurant, ran half the length of the building.
"Look at all those people."
"So what?"
"Oh, nothing," Barbara said. "I don't mind pulling up in front of all those people, getting out of the car with a ghostly young man who clearly has been sick all over himself, putting my snow skis on my shoulder and walking into a tropical hotel. Why should I mind?"
"Okay," Fletch started to get out of the taxi. "Stay here. I'll send you out a poached egg."
"Either we're going to end up in a Kenyan jail," Barbara said, following him, "or an asylum for the insane."
"Pay the driver, Barbara. You've got the money."
"I'll tip him," Barbara said, "asking him to forgive us and forget us."
In fact, the big doorman took the skis out of the trunk, brought them into the lobby, and stood them up against the wall as if this were something he did hourly. A few people on the veranda looked up and nodded at Fletch and Barbara. In the people's eyes was little more than mild curiosity.
Chapter 10.
"Hello?" There was a hesitation.
"Is this Mr. Fletcher?"
"Is this Mr. Fletcher, too?" Fletch answered. There was another pause.
"My name's Carr. I'm a friend of your father's. Are you all up there?"
"All who?" Fletch asked. "Up where?"
"Is your father with you? With you and your wife in your room?"
"I haven't seen him," Fletch said. "Ever."
"Oh. He told me we'd all meet here on Lord Delamere's terrace for a drink. Rather think the old boy wanted me along for moral support, don't you know? I understand the situation, father and son meeting for the first time."
Barbara was in the shower.
"More than I do, I expect."
Fletch had opened the knapsacks, gotten his shaving kit out.
"Well, I've got a table on the terrace. He'll turn up."
Slanted along the wall, propped against the windows, were the two pairs of snow skis. Outside the window, brilliant flowers were everywhere.
"I'll come down," Fletch said. "How will I know you?" "Well, we'll be two proper-looking gentlemen, I trust, with drinks in front of our faces, all eyes on the front door of the hotel."
Fletch chuckled. "Okay, but I'll be a few minutes. We've spent the last several months on airplanes, and you won't want to recognize me if I don't shave and shower."
"Right," Carr said. "We'll look for someone clean."
"Did I hear the phone?"
Barbara came out of the bathroom. Her head and torso were wrapped in towels.
"Yes." Shirt off, Fletch was going into the bathroom with his shaving kit.
"Was it your father?"
"No."
"Was it the police?"
"Why should it be? A friend of my father's, someone I guess my father wants present at the meeting for moral support. They'll be waiting for us downstairs on that veranda."
"Why didn't your father make the call?"
"He's not here yet."
"Barbara."
"Yes, darling."
"If we're to be married..."
"We were married. We are married.
Either I'll have to grow a beard or be able to see in the mirror so I can shave." You told me I had first dibs on the shower. Why steam up the room? Why shower with the door closed?
There was a phone extension in the bathroom.
What century do you belong to anyway? Why ever shower with the door closed?
The air's very dry here, see? She reached her hand into the bathroom, closed her fingers, and threw the steam out.
All gone.
I look lousy, he said, shaving.
Yes, she said solemnly. I was trying to spare you that view of yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you feel?
I'm no more jet-lagged than you are. We'll live through the day.
I can go down and say you're sick. You can meet these, your father tomorrow.
Why do that?
One shock to your system at a time. Isn't that what Aristotle said?
Aristotle said the roast lamb is very good today.
You're so contemporary.
When he came out of the shower, Barbara was still in her towels, but there were clothes all over the room. Ski clothes, sweaters, ski boots, ski goggles, gloves, a kit of ski wax.
Barbara looked perplexed.
Where are my clothes? Fletch asked.
In the laundry.
What laundry?
A man came to the door and said he wanted clothes for the laundry, so I gave him yours.
Very generous of you.
Mine too. Everything we were wearing on the plane.
Do I have any other clothes, I mean to wear?
No, she said, neither do I. Apparently not.
She waved her hand around the room.
Ski clothes.
Not even jeans?
I told Alston I wasn't going to see you in jeans on our honeymoon or sneakers, just ski clothes.
Great. He sat on the edge of the bed. Feet still on the floor, he lowered his back onto the bed. He was completely surrounded by ski clothes.
You're still wet, she said.
I won't catch cold. She took off her torso towel. She wiped him down lightly, just once, from his shoulders to his ankles. You missed the soles of my feet.
Raise your legs, she said.
Seeing everything else is up. She knelt. He put his knees over her shoulders.
Maypole, she said. Flagpole. Tower of London.
She was waving it back and forth.
There's nothing quite like it, rigid yet flexible.
Millions of things just like it, so I hear.
This is the one I've got a hold of.
Right, that's the one.
What will I do with it? She asked.
As you will, I can always grow another.
My father. My sneakers? He asked.
I gave them to the laundryman. I doubt you'll get them back. Fletch stood in the middle of the room, dripping from a second shower.
They'll be crocked by now.
She was lying on some ski clothes on the floor, still looking at the ceiling.
Who?
Your father and his friend. They'll be relaxed. You're relaxed. I figured he could wait. Barbara rolled on her side and put her head on the palm of her hand. She bent one knee.
You look much better now. Your color has come back.
Barbara, I have to meet my father for the first time dressed in ski clothes in equatorial Africa. Powder blue or rich yellow?
Wear your blue. It's sort of a formal occasion.
Ski boots?
Am I coming downstairs with you?
What do you think?
I think I could try to call my mother. She must be worried silly. I was supposed to call her, how many days ago? From Colorado.
Maybe I should meet him first myself. No distractions.
No moral support?
My morals don't need support.
He was pulling on nylon, form-fitting, powder-blue ski pants. She's probably been bothering the airlines, the police, hospitals, the ski lodge. She must be frantic.
I'm sorry. I should have asked Alston to call her.
What sense would he have made? Hello, Mrs. Ralton. Fletcher took your daughter to Africa. Said something about the white slave trade.
She rolled onto her back.
Oh, God, what am I going to say? Hi, Mom. The snow here is not at all that great for skiing. We're in Africa.
Is one of these sweaters at least lightweight?
Wear the red one.
It looks hot.
Roll up the sleeves. We miss doing what we said we were going to do by two whole continents and one huge ocean.
Just tell her you're all right.
Keeping her legs straight, she raised them off the floor and held them, tightening her stomach muscles. You're not going to talk to the police?
He was stomping into his ski boots.
One thing at a time, as you just said. Hey, Mom. You know those aquamarine shorts of mine? Could you send them to Nairobi? How's that for starters?
Sounds good. He clicked his boots shut and knelt on the floor. He leaned over and kissed Barbara. She ran her hand along the inside of his leg. You feel good even with pants on. The customs official thought they felt good, too. Strange customs. At the door, he said, "You'll come down in a while?" She rolled onto her stomach. "Sure, what did I say?" "Don't be disappointed." She winked at him. "You got it, babe." Chapter 11. There was only one proper-looking gentleman with a drink in front of his face, eyes on the front door of the hotel, when Fletch appeared on Lord Delamere's terrace in ski boots, powder blue ski pants, red sweater, sleeves rolled up, and sunglasses. At least there was only one proper-looking gentleman with drink in front of his face, eyes on the front door of the hotel, who gulped at the sight. Others glanced and continued chatting. That man began to rise, so Fletch went over to him. The man held out his hand. "I'm Carr, the four-door model." Shaking hands, Fletch said, "My father not here yet?" "Can't think what happened to him." The man sat down again. His beer glass was half empty. It was a round table with four chairs. Fletch sat across from him. Carr said, "You're a dazzler, absolutely a dazzler. Is that what they wear in America these days?" "When they're skiing." At a table near them sat two paunchy men in short safari suits, balding, florid-faced, wearing competitive handlebar mustaches. At another table sat a woman in black with a black picture hat. The man with her was in a double-breasted blue blazer, white shirt, and red tie. His hair was brilliantined. Jammed around another table were six students, male and female, black and white, jabbering excitedly, dressed in cutoffs and T-shirts. Two businessmen, briefcases on the floor beside them, talked earnestly at another table. Their white shirt cuffs and collars were between the perfectly matching blackness of their skins and suits. Many tables away, three women sat together in brilliantly colored saris. Almost everyone else on the terrace was dressed in long or short khakis. Carr asked, "Do you play the guitar?" "No," Fletch answered. "No talents." Carr himself was dressed in khaki shorts, long khaki stockings, a short-sleeved khaki shirt. He was a solidly built middle-aged man with big knees, big forearms, big chest, and not too much gut. His hair was thinning, sandy. Even though his skin was deeply tanned, there was a light sunburn on top of it, and a few freckles on top of the burn. His hands were large, strong, heavily calloused. His eyes were perhaps the clearest Fletch had ever seen. "How do you like the Norfolk?" Carr asked. "It seems authentic," Fletch said. "Perhaps the most authentic place I've ever been." Carr chuckled. "I expect it is. In the old days, you know, the cowboys would come in so dusty and thirsty, they'd ride their horses straight into the bar. The bar used to be through there in those days." He pointed to a blocked-off door. "Now that's a posh dining room. They'd be so dehydrated, half a drink would make them looped, and they'd start shooting the place up." He chuckled again. "I've been thrown out of here more times than I can recall." "I bet." Fletch doubted it. "Red, white, and blue." Fletch looked down at his powder blue pants and red sweater. "What's white?" "You are." "Oh, yeah, I forgot." A young waiter said to Fletch, "Jumbo." "Jumbo, Habari?"
"Habari buena?"
"Mzuri sana."
"Good God," Carr said. "You speak Swahili?"
"Why not?"
Fletch checked his watch. "I've been here 2.5 hours.
Carr gave Fletch a long look. Then he said to the waiter,
"Biri mbili, tahafadali."
He felt his glass.
"Baridi."
Very carefully, Fletch said,
"Baridi."
Laughing, Carr said, "You're a dazzler." The waiter went away. Americans never used to make an effort at languages. Fletch looked across Harry Thuku Road to Nairobi University. "Does my father speak Swahili?"
"Oh, yes, plus God knows what else. Has to, you see, flying small planes around the world. Here, 90% of the people speak English, 90% Swahili, and 90% speak at least one other tribal language."
"What are you?" Fletch asked.
"What do you mean?"
"Well, you could be English, American, South African, I suppose. Australian, from the way you sound."
"Not Australian," Carr said. "Not Australian.
That takes too much bloomin' work. I'm Kenyan. Turned in a British passport for a Kenyan passport and never regretted it. Live here a while and you're apt to sound like anything, I suppose. A cosmopolitan wee place. You're a pilot. Still flying, as they say. The man who appeared at my wedding last Saturday said nothing but handed me the package with the tickets in it to come here. Was probably a pilot, yes? Fletch was hot. The red sweater was prickling his skin. He was a little guy dressed in khaki, a blue tie. The International Brotherhood of Bush Pilots. Where else have you flown? Latin America, India, some in the States, other places in Africa. Smuggle? That's not my business. Does my father? That's not his business either. The waiter brought the beer. Fletch said, "Thanks, Buona." Carr smiled. He put his half-empty glass of beer onto the waiter's tray. "How is my father?" Fletch asked. Carr looked across the road. "We've all seen better days." "He must be rich." "Why do you say that?" "Tickets here for two plus $1,000, this hotel, that's a lot." "Not over a lifetime. Have you ever had anything else from him?" "No." "Did you come here only because you thought he might be rich?" "No. I was mildly curious." "He's not rich." "How do you suppose he knew I was getting married? Exact time, odd place. I barely made it myself." Carr seemed to be studying his rough hands. "I suspect your father's been hearing from you all your life." "Not from me." "Hearing of you. I've seen pictures of you." "Of me?" "In a schoolyard, walking along a street, in a football jersey, on a beach." "All those dirty old men taking pictures of me." "Pilot friends, I expect." Fletch grinned. "And all these years I thought it was because I was so pretty." "I take it you've never seen a picture of him." "No." "What were you told?" "I was allowed to think he was dead. He was declared dead legally when I was in the second year of school. I didn't know until last Saturday that my mother has always allowed for the possibility that he is alive. I guess she didn't want me to go off on some half-baked father search, you know, only to be disappointed." Carr's eyes opened wider. He shook his head. "Absolutely," he said. "This has to be Mrs. Fletcher." Fletch looked around. Outside the door of the hotel stood Barbara, in ski boots, powder blue ski pants, and a red sweater, sleeves rolled up. Chapter 12. "Three rabbits," Carr said to the waiter, "and I guess a beer for the lady." "Rabbit," Barbara said softly. "Americans don't eat rabbits." Carr had said they might as well have lunch. After he ordered, Carr was interrupted by a man who came by the table. There was a brief introduction. The man and Carr talked about flying some glass specimen boxes to Kitale. "This isn't your father?" Barbara whispered. "A friend of his, another pilot, name of Carr, first name unknown." "Where's your father?" "He doesn't know. I think he's rather embarrassed. He's here as moral support, and the old man isn't here at all. He's trying to be very nice." The conversation about glass specimen boxes was ending.